Hi, everybody. It's me. You know, who the hell else would it be? I recorded this week's episode from this really cool bougie boutique vintage cabin in the woods in Idlewild. And for the bulk of the episode, I'm going to be there, but I'm in the studio right now. I'm at home. I'm in the Blankenfoot recording studio. I just had some business I wanted to take care of right here at the top of the show before we get things really cooking. I had a Patreon patron. Shout out to my Patreon patrons, of course. We love them so much. Patreon.com/AustinArcher. But I had a friend on Patreon reach out and bring something to my attention. This person was trying to participate in Review the Review, which, if you don't know, is our segment on the show where listeners can review or rate this show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review, and I will read that review on the show. And this person informed me that if you are an Android user or you have a PC and you don't use Apple products, that most of those people are probably listening to the show on Spotify or on some other through some other means. And so I don't want to be a review the review snob and say that it has to be through Apple Podcasts. I think that's not fair. And I want anyone who wants to write a glowing and lovely review for the show to have their day in the sun and to be able to be heard by the other members of the Blankenfort Nation. So this is what my friend here has written, and it was really lovely. And the fact that it was written on Patreon, they sent it to me on Patreon and Messenger, and the fact that it was written there and not on Apple Podcasts meant that they were able to write a little bit more. And this is like, I mean, this is primo stuff. This is, I'm gonna say even before, I'm gonna call it, pointing to the stands, I'm gonna call it, this is the best review that anyone's ever written for the show. There have been many, many good ones. I always like them. I'm always very grateful for them, but this is the best one that anyone. It just is. This is the best one. Okay? So the gauntlet's been thrown down. You can go ahead and try to beat it if you want. You're more than welcome to, but this is the best one. And this is what it says. It says, "Ode to the Blanket Fort, a love sonnet." We're already off to a great start. "Dear reader, I implore you to invest your time and your attention in this show. For every topic, theme, and special guest will stir your thoughts in ways you'd never know. Come, be intrigued by matters of the spirit and harder truths of mental health and science. If curious and humble ears would hear it, find truth in social justice and defiance. Come revel in the mystic and mundane, the seat of art and music and creation. Come laugh and cry through comfort and through pain, for all are welcome in the Blanket Nation. This ode to Austin's work is just a teaser. My people, please enjoy the people pleaser." Whoo, I just got chills. Did you just get chills? Because I just got chills. Oh, dude, that was so good. Did you just get chills wherever you are on your walk doing the dishes? When you heard, I mean, can you believe it? Can you believe it? Come on, it's my birthday today. It's my birthday. I recorded this yesterday at the cabin in the woods. It was the day before my birthday. It's my birthday today. And ooh, y'all have been treating me good today. Y'all have been treating me good today. Got a whole bunch of new YouTube subscribers. Bunch of people bought the albums over on Bandcamp. Got a bunch of new Patreon patrons. Shout out to all the new patrons. Shout out to the OGs. God, I love y'all so much. Thank you so much for making it a special birthday. A few things that I want to say before we launch into this show. Like I said, I recorded this on my own, by myself up at this cabin in the woods, and it felt right. It was a cool setting. I wanted to do it up there. I brought my gear up there for a reason. A content warning. That's what I'll say. Content warning. I talk a little bit. I get into a little bit talking about some difficult subject matter. We talk a little bit about sexual assault and sexual predation and pedophilia, and just want to throw out a content warning there. But I was driving back from Idlewild today in the car, and I thought to myself, I wonder if I need to re-record that section of the show, or maybe I actually haven't listened to it yet. I'm sitting here, it's Monday night, and I actually haven't gone through and listened to it yet. And I was sort of thinking, should I try to re-record it? Because I know that what happened was, or my recollection of it is, I kind of started bouncing all over the place. And maybe it's because I recognized that I was becoming uncomfortable with the subject matter, or that I hadn't fully formed my thoughts on it. But you know what? You know what I'm thinking right now is that I'm going to let it ride. And I'm going to let you listen to this version of it. Where I'm sitting in this chair in this cabin in front of a fire, and like I think that what this show is and what I've always wanted it to be is me working through ideas in real time with you. You know, it's not me preaching a perfectly fully formed idea to you. It's me working through it a lot of times with guests and sometimes just on my own. And so this episode in many ways is like the purest form of what was behind me wanting to start this show, which is just the active process of working through ideas. And what I'm really talking about in this episode, what I really wanted to be talking about, is sort of the process of critical thinking that we all employ on a day-to-day basis, and sort of the value of embracing uncertainty and accepting that at the base level of anything that you're trying to suss out critically, that you're trying to think critically about, you have to acknowledge that there is a certain contingency of information that you just aren't going to know, whether it's because it involves multiple people's subjective experiences, and that's just something that you can't, as a third party or fifth party or whatever, you can't really be privy to the specific details of other people's subjective experience, or whether it's just because there's just aspects of it technically that you don't understand, that it's a scientific thing that you know it's a chemistry that you are not fully versed on, whatever it is. Like almost with everything in life, not even almost, at the very, very core, at the very bottom of it, is like this idea that it's like we try to know as much as we can, we try to gather as much information as possible, but at the very bottom we have to just embrace like the one thing I know for sure. The one thing in the entire universe I know for sure is that I don't know anything. And I'm not saying that to be like fake humble or anything like that. I'm saying that as a matter of like just blunt honesty, that the only thing I can actually say I know is that I don't actually know anything. I'm trying my best to gather as much information and to form a worldview that seems responsible and inclusive and thoughtful and compassionate and humane. I know that with me being a straight white cisgender male talking about some of these ideas and these concepts that I'm going to be talking about this episode, I know that at best it could come off as a little iffy or messy. And at worst, it could potentially come off as, thoughtless and careless and potentially even like dangerous or just like bad, cancel worthy. And I don't want that, but I guess I'm offering this up, saying this is me trying to work out some of these ideas, and rather than coming back here and panicking and trying to re-record it and do a better job of elaborating speaking my thoughts on what I'm trying to talk about, I'm just going to let it ride. I'm going to let you hear what I said last night, okay? So that's one of the big things that I'm talking about this episode, is sort of like the embracing the reality of uncertainty and of our lack of fundamental knowledge on things. And the other thing that I talk quite a bit about is The fact that it's the night before my birthday, and today it is my birthday, and the fact that I'm alone, and that's an aspect of my life right now. It's been an aspect of my life before, and so I want to do a little something different here right at the top of the show. Usually, you know, I play a little music that I've composed, you know the show, but I'm going to play a song for you that I wrote many years ago. Not many years ago, but this is from an EP that I released in 2018, and I think I wrote the song in about 2017. I'd been on my own. I've been single for about 4 years at that point, and I wrote this song called Being Alone for an EP that I released called You're Just Killing Your Poor Mother. And I don't know, it seemed really fitting. I was thinking about it today, spending my birthday weekend by myself, hanging out today in the Blankenfort recording studio in North Hollywood by myself, and thinking about this song. And I think I'm a different person. I know I'm a different person than I was when I wrote this song. I wrote this song before I was sober, you know, so I was still sad, Austin. The whole idea of that EP, by the way, you can find it on my Bandcamp. You can go get it, or you can find it on Spotify, Apple Music. It's a lovely little EP that it was before I was recording music in like a really professional way. So it's still got all of my roughness that my early recordings had. It's like super rough. It's super, it feels very homemade. But it was the idea behind You're Just Killing Your Poor Mother is that it was the last of my sad songs. It was me putting like the last of my super sad boy songs down so I could move on to something different, because I was ready to try to move on. I shortly thereafter got sober. I had a bunch of things change in my life, and I wrote the album Beautiful Things, which is a much more upbeat and hopeful album. But yeah, I was thinking about this song and thinking about how it sort of seems to pertain to the current moment and to some of the stuff that I'm exploring in this episode. So I'm going to play the full song and then we'll get into the episode. This is the song Being Alone from my 2018 EP, You're Just Killing Your Poor Mother. I hope you enjoy the episode, and you know, let me know in my messages if I'm canceled. It's okay if you feel like I am. We can talk about it. Reach out. All right, here we go.
Being alone is a capitalist handicap. It's so sad, it's a drag, it's a risk all you have. To protect you is you. Being alone isn't something you choose. It's a gift that is given, a permanent longing to you. Drive it to the mountains with no one to bother you. Well, that can be okay. Being alone, can be fun on your own. You can laugh at yourself and be naked at home. You can sleep on whichever side of the mattress you choose. Being alone don't mean you can't have friends, have a drink and unwind. If the universe ends, then who cares? I mean, who really cares? But drive into the desert with no one to cater to, well, that can be okay.
It's just me again this week. Kind of been going back and forth the last few weeks of like guest, mini-sode, guest, mini-sode. It's been hard for me to book my guests regularly like I used to, or line them up. I've been busy. I've been out of town a lot, bouncing around. And also the people that I've been trying to talk to keep having to reschedule. But it's okay. You don't mind that it's just me, do you? You don't mind that, right? You're not just here for the guests. Oh, you are? Okay. Well, all right. I'll see you next week then. And for those of you who are okay with just listening to me, I'll keep talking. Hey, how's it going? So here's where I am. How do I sound? First of all, first and foremost, how do I sound? Have you noticed? Did the episode start and you went, ooh, something's different? Or are you just now noticing? You might just be in your car with shitty speakers and it sounds the same as it does every week. But I bet Chris is noticing. I bet Chris, who mixes and masters the show, is noticing. Y'all, you know how I've been having microphone issues? I went and pulled the trigger and I got me a Shure SM7B. Now, for those of you who don't know, a Shure SM7B is like the industry standard podcasting mic. I've been dragging my feet on getting it because I got to do everything different. I gotta have the microphone that no one else has. I have to have like my unique microphone that works for my unique voice. And I'm not just going to have the microphone that everybody else is using. And I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. And that microphone that I had, my Warm Audio microphone that I really liked, it just stopped working on me. And, you know, I was over at Guitar Center getting a bunch of new gear for the Blankenfort recording studio. And I saw that these Shures were, you know, it was affordable. And I went, fine. And I got it, and I got it home, and when I first put on my headphones and started talking into it with the listening to myself in it, I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. What have I been doing? What have I been doing? Because listen to this. Listen, this is, after over 2 years of podcasting, we've made it. This is it. This is it. This is the podcasting microphone. I'm still bouncing all over the place. I'm still recording from my home studio like probably 30% of the time, and the rest of the time I'm on the road. Guess where I am right now? I'm at this really kitschy, vintage, cool cabin in Idlewild in Southern California in the woods. I'm just out at this cabin in the woods. I'm about 3 hours away from my 34th birthday, and I'm sitting in front of a roaring fire. Let me see if I can give you a little bit of fire noise. Let's see if you can hear it. I'm going to hold this up to the fire and see if you can hear the crackling. It was crackling just a bit ago. It's now stopped. But maybe you can hear the that the flames make. Let's see if you can hear it. You hear that? Maybe a little bit. Maybe I'm going to turn that part way up and see if you can hear it. There's a crackling fire. Not 3 feet from me. It's a real fireplace in this old vintage motel in the woods. It's dope. I'm in this little cabin. It's so cool, y'all. There's a hot tub here. I went hot tubbing last night. I'm treating myself. I've never done this before. I always feel so much pressure on my birthday to... Like, as an adult, nobody's putting together a party for me, ever, any year. If there's ever going to be a thing that's going to happen for my birthday, I have to do it. I have to, like, make sure I get all my friends together, and it's nice. I like a couple years ago, the last, like, big thing I did was the 2020 birthday. 2020 was January of 2020, so COVID... Man, it was a whole, imagine that. It was a whole different universe. We went to a restaurant, and not that I go to restaurants now with people, but I got together with like 12 of my friends at this restaurant and not a mask in sight because that wasn't even a thing. We didn't even know what that even was. And we had tapas, sharing plates. We're passing plates around with small, you know, little shareable small plates, and everyone's getting their... That we're all sharing, and you just wouldn't see that. You wouldn't see that today. And that was my last kind of like big birthday thing I did. Last year, some friends and I and Mary got together in a park near my apartment, and we had a pizza party, and it rained on us, and it was like five of us, and we were sitting in the rain eating pizza in the park outside, and we did it. We hung out for like 45 minutes, and then we all went home because it was too cold and wet. And you know, I was looking at my birthday coming up and not knowing what I was going to do this year and thinking, should I try to get friends together? Should I try? And I had this, you know, I'm sort of splitting duty here. I have a work opportunity here. I'm making some content for this little kitschy motel in the woods that I'm staying at. They asked me to make some content for them for social media. And the guy said, can you come and like stay and check out the premises for a few days before you shoot stuff? Could you just like come and like come in? Ooh, one of the logs just fell off the thing and it's just like on fire on the floor. Luckily there's a big fire grate in front of it, but it's getting a little wild over here. I don't know if you heard that. It was like, but, I decided I'm going to come out to this place on my birthday weekend. And I had the option of like, should I invite a friend or two? I didn't know which room they were going to give me. Some of their rooms only really sleep like one to two people comfortably. They gave me the biggest room. I'm in a room that has two floors and three bedrooms. So I definitely could have and maybe should have brought friends. But I'm telling you, I was a little apprehensive. I was leaving the house yesterday to come down here. And I was like, what if it's like way lonely and way sad? And I'm like, oh, I'm 34 and I'm alone on my birthday. And that's so pathetic and sad. And I got here and instantly I was like, oh, this place is so dope. And I have just been taking full advantage of every amenity. I've been enjoying I hot tubbed last night. I went on a hike today, a gorgeous sunset hike. I've been eating at the local eateries. There's a little town about a mile and a half away from where I'm staying. And I've been eating at the different restaurants, had breakfast at a spot today. Last night I had a great salmon dinner at this really like probably the nicest restaurant in town. And then tonight I ate at a sports bar and grill where I watched some good playoff football and had a great burger. And honestly, if I'm being real, the burger might have been better than the salmon dinner. The salmon dinner was good. It was very good. The salmon dinner was better. I had chocolate mousse for dessert. It was delicious. The chocolate mousse had a perfect texture, a perfect consistency. It was really, really great. It's just been kind of fantastic, actually. And I haven't really been too down on myself for like not having a conventional birthday. I think it's okay to just like be on your own sometimes, you know? And that's what I'm doing. And it's all right. It's all good, you know? Talked a little bit with my family today on FaceTime and it's good. Yeah, I don't know. I think I was worried. I think I was coming in here worried a little bit that I was going to like get kind of existential and kind of and be like, what am I doing with my life? But if anything, I've just sort of been looking around the last couple of days and being like, wow, I have such a crazy life. I have so much abundance in my life. My life is really, truly incredible. I sat on this big boulder looking at the sunset tonight for like 30 minutes and got to do a little meditation, a little prayer, and just thinking about how incredibly abundant my life is, and just that everything on top of just the fact that I get to be here to experience the abundance of the human experience with take away money, take away career, take away friendships, just the fact of being here to witness things like sunsets and the overwhelming abundance of gorgeous scenery in the world, and the fact that there's just so much to do in a single day. So much entertainment, so much to busy myself with every single day. And I don't know. I feel good. It's a good birthday. I think I'm going to remember this birthday. This feels important somehow. I've never done this. I've literally never taken myself on a trip before. I'm always with somebody. I'm always with somebody. If I'm ever going to do something special or momentous or big, I've always got to have someone there, almost like a witness to be like, to validate it, that like that person's also seeing what I'm seeing and experiencing what I'm seeing, experiencing. I sat in this hot tub last night for like an hour and I was like, and I kept thinking like, I wish there was someone here to talk to. And then I was like, but why? Why? What would that actually do? I do like talking with people, but mostly what I'm meant to be experiencing right now is how nice this water feels. How nice this view is. How fresh the air is, you know? It's crisp outside of the water, really warm inside of the water. That's what I'm meant to be experiencing. And you know, I'm getting to experience it. So anyway, that's where I am with my nice microphone. I brought all my gear with me because I figured I might want to make a little content, make and record the podcast while I'm up here. I thought, why not? And yeah, here I am. Speaking of abundance, I talked about this on the podcast at the end of the episode last week, but I thought I'd start it off at the beginning. I'm over a million followers. I'm sure you're aware by now, but I got over a million followers on TikTok. Again, abundance, wild, unforeseeable, surprising abundance. Feels a little late in life, 34, to seemingly just be starting. I feel like every time I listen to a podcast featuring someone that I admire, someone who's in show business or something, and they're talking about the trajectory of their career, almost without fail, they've all been around the right people since they were like 20. You know, like they all like went to college with other famous people or like have been around doing it for a long time. And maybe they didn't get their first big like breakthrough thing till 25 or 26, but they've been around. So 34 for me to the last couple of years have been the unquestionably the biggest years of my career. Most noticeably because I was introduced to all of you. Or rather, you were introduced to me. I haven't met all of you, but you were introduced to me. We got to start this thing that we're doing. And it's brought me all kinds of opportunities that I've never had before. And yeah, 34 feels late, I guess. But also, like, I like it. I like that I'm doing it that way. I kind of like in... Do you hear that? Maybe not. It's far away, but there was a big pop. The fire did a big pop. So if you heard it even faintly, that was the fire. But I like not being a typical actor type. I think my whole life, and I've always been friends with actors. Of course I have. They're the people that I work with. Like I've always been friends with other actors and other artists and stuff. But there's like a certain stereotype of actor, and you all know what it is. It's the way that actors are portrayed satirically in movies and in on TV and stuff. And like that person exists to an extent. They're not always that vain or that vapid, but there definitely is this kind of person who like their entire identity is wrapped up in like the biz and the industry and knowing all the terminology and knowing everybody, knowing the names of every casting director and every casting office. And there are those people, and I'm not ragging on those people. Again, I'm friends with these people. I'm friends with actors, but I've always wanted to be a person outside of that. Does that make sense? I've always wanted to have an identity outside of that. I've always wanted to be like accepted and validated by society just as like a normal guy also, you know? I don't want to just be the guy that the only thing I can talk about or have an intelligent conversation about is show business, you know? And I think that I manage that. I think that this podcast is proof that I manage that. I've never even done an episode about show. I've done an episode about comedy, like the comedy industry. And that's as me as an outsider, as a person who's not a comedian. I've done an episode about like certain movies that I like, but I don't think I've ever talked about like being an actor. I've talked about music a little bit, but like I talk about a lot of things because I just want to be a well-rounded person. And I think that starting late, and that's what this feels like to me these last couple of years, it feels like some stuff is beginning. It feels like I'm starting to break through and starting to see the potential of an actual career as an entertainer. And I don't know. I think starting later, getting an audience later, feels right for me. It makes me just feel like I'm continuing that trend of like being a little bit of an outsider and a little bit of a different kind of guy in the biz, and that works for me. That's good. Anyway, over 1 million followers. It's wild. And I'm not, this year I'm trying to build up YouTube. So if you're not already subscribed to the YouTube page, please go do that. God, abundance, right? So thankful. I think I'm just trying right now, 3 hours away from being 34, to say thank you in a really long, in my typical long-winded way, to say thank you for being here and thank you for all of your support and thank you for liking what I do and thank you for commenting and sharing and reaching out and messaging and like, thank you. And God, if you're on my Patreon, thank you. Thank you. You can always join my Patreon for my birthday. You want to send me a Venmo for my birthday? You can do that. You can buy one of my albums for my birthday. Do all three. The very least, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel. If you're not going to do anything else, that's free. That's freezy peasy. Just trying to grow over there this year. So that's where I am. What I wanted to talk about today. Thought a lot about this. I was like, what do I want to talk about tomorrow? I'm bringing my equipment up. What do I want to talk about? Sometimes I really know, and sometimes I have to kind of like think. And I think I'm going to be relatively quick about this. We'll see. We'll see once I'm done. But wanted to talk about a little bit about critical thinking and about kind of concepts like Occam's razor and things like that. You're familiar with Occam's razor, right? You know, the idea that the simplest explanation is most likely the correct one, right? You know, in a situation that baffles you or that you're uninformed on or you're unaware of what the correct answer or idea is that you should be after, that just the simplest one, whichever one seems most likely and requires the least amount of suspension of disbelief, the one that is a good bet, you know, a safe bet. And I think that this is such a common thing in everyday life. There's so many situations where we employ this. And I think that, so a few things I want to talk about today: critical thinking, this idea of like the commonality of Occam's razor, and also just like the ability and willingness to every single day on a daily basis be okay with uncertainty and with not knowing things. My friend Emily Walton said this last week, and it's been really ringing in my head ever since we spoke. She said it on the podcast where she said her therapist told her that anxiety is the inability to tolerate uncertainty. And every single time since then that my anxiety has been creeping up on me, I think about that. I think about the fact that right now I am being intolerant of uncertainty, and all I need to do to feel better about this is just to simply allow myself to tolerate the fact that I am experiencing some form of uncertainty, and that that's okay. And making that a daily practice, like practicing not knowing things and being okay with not knowing things and going to what seems to be a reasonable place first. If you have to go anywhere at all, if you feel the need to land anywhere at all, or if you're in a situation that demands that you have some kind of stance, pick the one that is that's you know, the shortest point or path between two points. There's a few things that happened to me anecdotally that made me want to think about this, and I'll tell you these anecdotes. The first one is this kid reached out to me, as happens from time to time on Instagram or on TikTok, in private messenger. He had first commented on a video saying that he thinks that my political takes are really bad. Like, he said something like, it's so funny when Austin thinks that he's making a good argument. He has such bad arguments, but his music is great. And I typically try to avoid that stuff if at all possible. I really, really do. It's a problem. It's something that I'm trying to work on. It's something that I am actively trying to get better at, is not taking the bait on stuff like that and allowing people to just like say what they're going to say in the comments. But every once in a while I see something and it hits me the wrong way, or I'm in the wrong energy that day, haven't meditated that day, haven't done my work, and my ego gets caught up in that. So I responded to this kid. I said something like, I'll debate you on anything you want anytime. Like, if you think that I have bad arguments and you think you have something to teach me, I'll debate you on anything. I got kind of aggro with him. I was like, anytime, anywhere. Like, you name the place and time, you name the topic, I'll be there. I'm confident I'll wipe the floor with you, like, on anything, you know? I got real uppity. And I didn't know at the time that he was a kid. I don't know who people are. He had a screen name that, and it didn't indicate how old he was. His profile didn't have any photos to indicate roughly how old he was. Anyway, we wound up private messaging each other, and I found out that he was 18, and that made me think, oh, geez, what am I doing? I'm talking to an 18-year-old kid. Of course he doesn't know anything. Found out he was, like, actually a genuine fan. He was, like, he kind of backtracked, which happens sometimes when I call people out, when people talk a big game in the comments, and then I say, like, no, okay, well, let's talk. They'll backtrack. They'll go, like, I'm actually a big fan of yours. I just disagree with you politically on some things, you know, and that happens. And that's actually, I think that's a compliment. The fact that there are people who disagree with me politically, which is a big portion of my content and a big portion of what I talk about online, and who still like me, who still like what I do artistically. I think I take that as a compliment. So anyway, this kid and I wound up throwing some ideas back and forth to each other. We really disagreed on a lot of things, but I thought, you know what? He seems curious and inquisitive. And so I tried to offer helpful solutions, and he was actually receptive to a lot of what I said. Anyway, this kid DM'd me the other day, and he said, hey, can I ask you a question? And I genuinely want your help with this. And I said, sure, what is it? And he said, can you help me out with the vaccine, because my friends and family won't leave me alone about my decision to not be vaccinated. They're making me feel really bad about it, and they're making me feel really bad about myself for choosing not to get vaccinated, and I don't feel like they should make me feel like I'm a bad person just because I'm making a personal choice. And he goes, can you help me with this? Like, am I missing something? Am I being the asshole here? Help me out. And so I responded to him. I said, well, okay, so let me ask you, why don't you want to get the vaccine? And he wrote back and he said, he goes, I'm not anti-vax. I'm pro-vaccine. I'm just not pro this vaccine. You've heard this line before from lots of people, right? Who are like, I'm not anti-vax. I'm just anti-COVID vax. And so I wrote back again. I said, okay, can you elaborate on that? Can you tell me why you're anti-COVID vaccine? And he said, I've never taken a vaccine that was genetically engineered before. And so this is where we begin with the topic of what I want to talk about, which is, like, I then proceeded to try to see if I could lead this young man down a path of critical thinking and employing a lot of Occam's razor. So the questions I started asking him were, how much do you know about genetic engineering and about vaccine development, about virology, about epidemiology? How much do you actually know, being honest? And then I told him, because my answer to all of that is, I don't know jack shit. I'm not asking you this from a position of saying, I know. Do you know as much as I know? Do you know? I'm saying this as a vaccinated person, that I'm asking you, are you intricately aware of the process of creating an mRNA vaccine and what the quote-unquote genetic engineering that is employed to make that, what that actually is, what that actually means? Because I said, it sounds to me like you're being fed a pretty steady diet of misinformation. And you've heard this word, genetic engineering or genetic modification, and it sounds really scary to you. And I don't think it is what you think it is. I think that you think that they're literally going in and, like, changing your DNA, and you're going to cease to be a human being, and you're going to be, like, half reptilian or something. And it's not that. But my question to you is, like, do you actually know what that means? Do you actually know what a genetically engineered vaccine is? And then furthermore, do you know at all what goes into vaccines. Have you any vaccine that you've ever had? If you've been vaccinated for polio or smallpox or the flu, if you get the flu shot every year, do you know specifically what is going in to make that year's flu shot? And do you know specifically how it's going to interact with your body specifically and whether or not you're going to have an adverse reaction to it? Like, are you intricately aware of what goes into ibuprofen, how NyQuil is made, Robitussin? Do you actually know these things? And I'm betting when I'm asking these questions that the answer is no, because my answer to these questions is no. I asked all those questions, and he goes, I think I see what you're saying. He goes, I don't know. And he goes, this just one thing makes me scared. And I go, so okay, so if you can acknowledge that you don't know what's in, you don't really know what's in Diet Coke. Like, you don't know what's in these things, and yet you're able to rationalize that enough people take ibuprofen on a daily basis, and enough people take NyQuil, and enough people drink Diet Coke, even though we know that Diet Coke's like really bad for us in lots of ways, and that soda in general is really bad for us, but enough people do it on a day-to-day basis without dropping dead immediately, that we can be reasonably assured that it is a reasonably safe thing to do within certain parameters, right? And that's sort of our reasoning, is just like, I don't actually know what's in this, but I just, based on what little data I can observe from just the amount of people who have taken it who are okay, that makes sense. If you are willing to do that with all these other things, if you're willing to trust medical scientists and virologists and epidemiologists to engineer a flu vaccine for you, or a polio vaccine for you, or a smallpox vaccine for you, knowing that you don't know how to do that, you're not personally capable of creating that, why would you trust them with all of that and on this one thing think, but on this thing they're lying, on this thing they're involved in some kind of nefarious scheme, some kind of nefarious plot? On all the other stuff, they're being straightforward and pretty reliable and pretty stand up and honest about it. But on this one thing, for whatever reason, they're like being straight up evil. And so I just sort of led him down that path. And that just got me thinking about just the way that we problem solve, the way that we move through issues that are perplexing or that are difficult or dicey, complex conversations that are hard. It's like, You gotta be willing to suss it out. You gotta be willing to work it out. A guy the other day, again, I'm still having this conversation with people, and again, I gotta stay out of the comments, but this guy got me into a conversation, and quickly into the conversation, this person I didn't wind up private messaging and developing a friendship with. I blocked this person. But this guy said, he commented on one of my videos and said, like, Biden shouldn't be president. And I wrote back, I said, why? And he said, because the election was stolen. And I said, why do you think that? And he said, because we have proof that there's videos of people dumping Trump ballots in a garbage can. And I said, you think that that was the plan to steal the election, is that they were going to pay off poll workers or ballot counters to, in view of other people and in view of cameras, to just dump Trump ballots in the garbage? You think that that was the plan? There's all these different narratives, like the Biden-Harris bus that pulled up outside of a Arizona polling station and unloaded a bunch of fake Biden-Harris ballots into the station. I'm like, that's the plan? You gotta be willing to, like, work this out with me. Work this out with me, that this was the idea, was they were like, here's how we're going to carry out one of the most coordinated and smooth and nefarious frauds in the history of the United States. We're just gonna sort of roll up to the front door and just sort of put a bunch of fake ballots in there in front of a bunch of people and in front of a bunch of cameras. And we're just going to have, like, workers there. Trump's going to have people in his camp who are watching, just like we'll have people who are watching. And in full view, we're just going to sort of do it. We're just going to cheat. And then all of the judges who hear the lawsuits on this, all of the Trump-appointed judges, Republican judges, are going to, for some reason, throw out that evidence, that really clear evidence that like multiple eyewitnesses watched this very obvious fraud taking place. So I asked this person, I said, you think that's how this works? You think this is like a high school election where they're like, we want Tracy to be prom queen, not Susie. So we're going to throw out all the Susie ballots. And it's just like four people counting ballots in the student government room. You think that that's how this went down? And trying to just get this person to go through the process. Now, this person was showing no ability to do that. They were getting dumber with each progressive comment. So I did cut them off and block them. And I got out of there. But my point is, in these instances, so going back to uncertainty, because here's the bottom line with did Biden steal the election? And even with the vaccine, is the vaccine poison that's going to kill all of us in 2 to 3 years? At the real core bottom, the very, very bottom of those debates, of those issues, the honest thing, the most honest thing I can say and should say is, I don't actually know. I'm not actually aware or able to say whether the vaccine is poison that's going to kill me in 2 to 3 years. I guess I'll know in 2 to 3 years. And maybe after that, they'll move the goalposts to like 5 years. And then I guess I'll know in 5 years. I don't actually know. I wasn't there. I wasn't in the room where the vaccines were made. I wasn't one of the people on the development team. I'm not an insider at Pfizer or Moderna or Johnson & Johnson. I don't actually know. I'm not part of the campaign, the Biden-Harris campaign team. I'm not part of the Democratic National Convention. I don't actually know whose hands money traded between to make which plan come to fruition and in which way. I don't actually know. I cannot definitively say that there wasn't some kind of attempted steal of the 2020 election. I can say that it makes sense that there's enough on the line that someone would try to cheat in an election. Donald Trump has said multiple times that he would just cheat if he lost. And that's what he did. He just said, "Fine, I'm just going to try to authoritarian style overthrow the government then, you know, and just sort of muscle my way back into the presidency." He said before his election with Hillary that he would just claim fraud if he lost. Like, you know, like I believe that cheating is not out of the question. It's not out of the realm of possibility of something that could happen. But again, I need to be able to like work it out. I need to be able to work out how and what the logistics are. And they need to make sense in an Occam's razor type way. It needs to be an explanation that I can actually like see. Because I can see fraud happening in an election. Fraud in elections worldwide happens all the time. It's not hard to imagine why fraud would take place. There's motive there. There's a clear reason why. But you need to be able to tell me a better story than they pulled up in a van outside of a ballot counting station in Arizona and they just loaded in all of the fake ballots. Or they dumped Trump ballots in the garbage. You got to be able to tell me a better story than that. You know? You got to be able to tell yourself a better story than that. You got to be able to work out a better idea of how this happened, how this worked out. So going back to uncertainty again, because at the very bottom of it all, the honest, real thing is I don't know. It's just that what seems most reasonable and most simple to me is that the data that I'm seeing is that, and again, I don't actually know who's creating the data. I have to trust that the systems that are put in place and the checks and balances that are put in place in the medical community would make it hard for someone, anyone, even a very powerful organization to like falsify data on a global scale like this. So my reasoning, my critical thinking, my Occam's razor reasoning is telling me that it would be very difficult to forge worldwide medical data stating that the overwhelming majority of hospitalizations and deaths post-vaccine rollout have been unvaccinated people. Because that is the data that we've seen on vaccines, on the COVID vaccine so far, is that the overwhelming majority of hospitalizations and deaths after the vaccine was made available have been from unvaccinated people worldwide. And again, I don't actually know the specifics of how that data was made and how it came to be. I just have to believe that it would be very, very hard to get false numbers like that past the entire global medical community, or to get their cooperation, to get the cooperation of the entire global medical community on this one thing. Because even these people that propagate these conspiracy theories, like, these people go to the hospital when they get sick. They go to the doctors when they get sick. How weird that you believe that apparently these people are in on a global conspiracy to kill you with a nefarious, poisonous vaccine, but you will trust them to do life, to take life-saving measures if your ivermectin fails. Life-saving measures that you likely don't understand. Pump you full of things in an IV that you don't really know how it works, but like, you're just trusting that it works. I doubt you understand like how a ventilator actually works, you know, how it's built, how it's engineered, how it's made. You just trust that it does something to help you breathe better and keep you alive a little longer. But usually once you hit the vent, it's kind of all downhill from there. It's kind of a, you know, but yeah. So my point is, I don't know. I don't actually, I personally, I'm just an idiot on the internet with a mustache who makes silly videos. I don't know how to make a vaccine. I don't know what's actually in it. I wasn't actually present at the strategy meetings for the Biden-Harris 2020 presidential campaign, or any of the insider meetings for the Democratic National Committee. I don't know. What makes sense to me is that the most reasonable explanation is that. So that's my first anecdote, is talking to this kid. And that's, I'm setting up this idea of accepting that at the very bottom, you have to be okay with, I don't know, really, truly, honestly, but also like, most likely the direction I'm being pulled in is this. Now, this second story I'm going to tell you is a story where at the end of it all, I'm more in a nebulous place, where I'm like, the ending point for this next story is an ending point where I still genuinely don't know. And I am preferring to actually stay in that place because it seems to me to be the most intellectually honest place to be. I actually feel in this instance that to take any stance other than I simply don't know is kind of reckless and irresponsible. So here's the story. I was doing this shoot a few weeks ago, about a week and a half ago, and the makeup and wardrobe person, we were chit-chatting as we do when, you know, you're sitting in the chair, you're getting your hair done, you're getting your makeup done. I had a lot of makeup on this shoot, so it was like I was in the chair for like an hour and a half getting makeup done, and so we were chitting and chatting and getting to know each other. You try to keep it light. You try to keep it fun, pleasant. You try not to get into anything that might offend anybody, because you don't know who you're working with. And I was working in Utah too, so you really don't know who. We try not to share our opinions on whether or not we think mask mandates are fair and good. You know, you might do a little prodding to see if like the person that you're talking to, if they're an insane person or not. But anyway. Somebody brought up, I can't remember who, brought up Bob Saget. Now, Bob Saget died recently. I don't know if you know that. I'm sure you saw it. And he just died unexpectedly. They think he died of like a heart attack. I'm not even sure if they found a cause of death yet, but it was very sudden and unexpected. These two women started speaking very confidently about how Bob Saget was a known sexual predator, that he was like a bad guy, they were saying that he's like a known pedophile, that he had like sexually assaulted multiple minors and children. And I was a little taken back. I'm friends with Bob Saget's wife on TikTok. We follow each other, and we've chatted pleasantly from time to time on private message, just to exchange, you know, I really like what you're doing over here, your content. Oh, I like, you know, what you're doing too, and just pleasantries. She seems like a very pleasant person, very nice person. I felt bad for her, but they seem to have a really nice marriage, normal marriage. And now, before I talk about this, I feel like I need to preface, and I'm probably going to need to say it multiple times throughout. I want to be really, really clear here that what I'm not doing as I talk about this is refusing to acknowledge the truth of victims. I'm definitely not, like, taking the man's side or, like, you know, not believing a victim or anything. And specifically because, and I'll get into this a little bit later, just because I haven't been able to find an actual victim. But the point of this story is that these women were speaking very, like, boldly and certainly and very confidently about the, almost as if it was an established fact that, not even almost, it, in their view, it was an established fact and a truth that Bob Saget was a known pedophile. And I just sort of gently asked, I said, oh, I've actually never heard this before. Where did you hear this? I mean, where would I be able to find this? And they said, oh, do you not know this? It's, everyone knows this. It's like a very well-known thing. And they were kind of shocked that I hadn't heard about it. And I said, yeah, I've actually never heard this before. And I wasn't denying it. I wasn't saying, like, I think you're lying. I'm definitely not calling, I'm still not calling them liars. And I'm still not, like abjectly denying this. My point is that, like, I had never heard of it before, and nobody, I'd been seeing, you know, different celebrities and comedians talking about Bob, and I hadn't seen anywhere, I hadn't seen on any news outlets or anything about, like, you know, in the wake of Bob Saget's death, like, we take a look back at these allegations that were made at this certain time. I just hadn't heard anything about this. And I said, where could I look this up? And they said, yeah, just look it up. Like, look up Bob Saget sexual assault. And I said, okay. So right there in the chair, I'm in the chair, I pull out my phone, Bob Saget sexual assault allegations. And, like, the first, I mean, I'm scrolling through like 10, 15 different articles and, like, nothing. There were, like, articles that mentioned his name and the word sexual assault, but they weren't related. They were just, like, both in the article. You'd think with something as high profile and as established and well known as they were making it sound, I would be able to find an article somewhere. I couldn't. I said, so I asked them again. I said, I'm not finding anything here. I've searched a few different keywords. I searched Bob Saget sexual predator. I searched Bob Saget pedophilia. What does come up if you search Bob Saget pedophilia is, like, there's one tabloid headline from, like, back when he was on Full House, from something that looks like the National Enquirer, where it says something about, like, you know, Bob Saget and his dark secret with the Olsen twins or something. But it was, like, a very tabloidy looking thing, very unreliable looking thing. And that's the only thing I could find. And also, he used to tell, I don't know if you know this, but Bob Saget was known as a very off color and very, like, perverse comedian. And he would tell pedophile jokes. And now, that's probably the most damning evidence against him, if there's any, is that we know from people like Louis C.K. that when comedians joke about stuff that is, you know, off color or socially unacceptable, it can be a window into a private truth. You know, Louis C.K. loved to joke about masturbation and jerking off, and like, he was telling us who he is, and then we found out that, like, he has this kink about masturbating in front of people, and that there was that it's a problem in his life, and that we found out that the jokes were alluding to some kind of truth. So if there's any kind of evidence linking Bob Saget to any kind of it's that he was known for telling these jokes that no one else would tell. One of his jokes that was very, one of his, like, famous jokes is he would say, you know, they say in Hollywood that you're supposed to, that the youngest you can date is half your age plus seven. And he goes, I missed the part about half your age and I just went with seven. And so, like, it's this very off-color pedophile joke about dating a 7-year-old. Yeah, it's gross. It's a gross joke, but it's also like, it's a comedian's kind of joke. It's like, Bob Saget is known as like a comedian's comedian because comedians around other comedians love to talk, to joke about things that you're like not supposed to joke about. And, you know, it's dead baby jokes. It's the aristocrats. It's Holocaust jokes. It's things like that. It's gallows humor. Little bit about Bob Saget. I actually wound up doing quite a lot of research on him because of this conversation I had with these women. You know what? I'll actually get into that later. I want to stick with the story. I'm kind of going all over the place. So I'm still in this room. I'm still looking up. I'm still trying to find something about what these women are saying because they're like looking at me like, how do you not know this? And I said, do you know what it was? Do you know who it was? Like, do you know if there was like a victim? And they go, oh, it was the Olsen twins. He did stuff with the Olsen twins. And I went, oh my God, you're kidding me. And they said, yeah, it's the Olsen twins. So I looked up, that was the next thing I looked up was like Bob Saget, pedophilia, Olsen twins. And that's when I saw the like National Enquirer looking headline thing. But that was like deep in the search. That was, I had to like search through several things before I found that. The first things that came up when I searched Bob Saget and the Olsen twins is tweets from the Olsen twins after his death saying, we're so saddened to hear of the loss of Bob Saget. He was one of the kindest men we ever worked with and one of the nicest people in the entire showbiz industry, which is kind of all I heard across the board from different celebrities was like Bob Saget's like the nicest guy in the world. I mean, yeah, he was a gross guy. He was a filthy comedian, but you couldn't find a nicer guy. He was a father to three daughters. And like he, you know, like everyone was just saying like, couldn't find a nicer guy. He'd just call you up out of the blue to tell you how much he loved you. The Olsen twins tweeted about this guy who apparently was well known for sexually assaulting them and just said he was the nicest guy we ever met and we are so saddened to hear of his loss. So I say that to these two women that I'm working with. I say, hey, I just Googled that and all I can find here is that the Olsen twins are saying that they tweeted about him and they're saying how much they loved him and how much he meant to them and now he was the nicest guy they ever worked with. And they to watch their faces change over this process, it got uncomfortable in the room because the feeling was that I was pressing them and I wasn't just taking their story at face value and just going, oh, you don't say, Bob Saget's a known pedophile? Wow, how about that? I didn't know that, but I guess he is. And I think that with celebrities and with public figures, we are way too reticent to do that. Like, we hear a story about someone famous that's like, oh, did you know that this person, do you know that Richard Gere put a gerbil up his ass? Like, we hear a story like that about celebrities, and we don't even stop to think if it could be true or not. We just go, oh, yeah, I guess he is. Like, I guess so. And again, I am not taking a stance that Bob Saget never did do anything wrong or never made anyone feel. My stance on this is I genuinely don't know. It's impossible for me to know. What I would like to be able to see is something a little bit more firm, like Dylan Farrow, for instance, the daughter of Woody Allen, who for about 30 years now has maintained the exact same story that her father did indeed molest her when she was a child and multiple times. And she's now a grown woman. And she still says with 100% conviction, yes, that happened when I was a kid. My father, Woody Allen, molested me. And like Woody Allen married his stepdaughter, Su Yin, when she was 16, they started dating. So like, We know that Woody Allen more than likely did that shit. And fuck Woody Allen, by the way. Fuck Woody Allen for real. I want to see something a little bit more concrete like that. I've got a tattoo of Michael Jackson on my arm, you guys. Because for most of my life, Michael Jackson was my hero and my idol. Because I loved the way that he moved. I loved the femininity that he presented himself with and the way that he kind of redefined what it meant to be a pop star and a pop performer. I just saw him as such an icon and legend. And I sort of refused to believe anything bad that I heard about him for the longest time, even though the evidence of that was just like all up in all of our faces. And I think a lot of people refuse to believe it about Michael Jackson because we just fucking love him. We just, he's just so beloved. And then that HBO documentary came out, and Leaving Neverland. If you've never seen it, you should watch it if you can handle that. It's pretty harrowing stuff. But yeah, I watched that and it kind of devastated me. Like, I had to accept then, like, there was just no hiding from it. It was just so clear that, like, yes, that stuff happened. For sure, for sure, for sure. Michael Jackson, 100%, sexually assaulted many, many little boys. And, yeah, can't hide from that, you know? But again, like, I don't just think that because I heard someone say it one day, you know? Like, if I'm going to be able to reach a place of some kind of conclusion on something like that, I need to be able to get there with a more reasonable process, if that makes sense. And again, I know that this is going to sound like I'm saying that we should, like, not believe women when they come forward with allegations of sexual assault or not believe victims. That is not what I'm saying. It is always a good default position to take to treat victims as though they are telling the truth when they tell you about something that has happened to them. To have that as your default position, to treat them as though they have been through something traumatic and difficult, because chances are they most likely have. If they are sharing something that serious with you, chances are they most likely have. What I will say is, I think that in order to uniquely appreciate the reason why I have the position that I have on this and the feelings that I have on this, you need to have been in a position where you've had people say something awful about you that is just blatantly untrue. And I have been in that position twice now. I never thought it would happen to me, but it happened once when I was 21 years old, and it happened again very recently. Without going into too many details on it, somebody, for whatever reason, said that I did something objectively awful, something illegal, something really, really bad that I just didn't do. And it's such a perplexing and strange place to find yourself in. The first time it was said was for different reasons, and I've actually spoken with that person since and figured out what actually happened and went on and where, how that came about. And the second time, what happened was I went and did that show Mormon Stories. I was on Mormon Stories, and I found out the hard way that John DeLynn and Kara Burrell over there at Mormon Stories, they've got a pretty active and devoted troll army that follows them around and follows anyone that works with them around. And no sooner than I did that show did someone reach out to John with a private message alleging some pretty heinous criminal behavior that I had apparently done that wasn't true. And John showed it to me just respectfully, just said, "Hey, I just want to bring this to you." And he goes, "Have you ever heard this before? Have you ever heard anyone say this about you before?" And I said, "No, I haven't. This is the first I'm hearing of it." And I kind of freaked out about it for a few days. I was kind of freaking out thinking whoever is saying this, is it's a matter of time before they go public with it. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and I was like, what do I do? Should I try to like find who this person is and see if I can reason with them or talk to them? And my sponsor looked at me and he said, "Look at me. Did you do this thing?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Okay, then don't worry about it." And I think that what I learned is that part of the price of being a more public person and having more eyes on me is that people are just gonna say stuff. And so again, this is not a rant to be anti-cancel culture or to be anti-accountability. I think it's important that we hold people accountable for criminal behavior and for bad things that they do. I just think it's also important that we that we do our due diligence when we hear something about somebody that we don't know, that we acknowledge that, like, when you hear something about a celebrity, and I'm not saying that I'm a celebrity, but I'm saying when you hear something about someone that you've never actually personally met, some rumor that someone tells you, I heard that someone who worked with them on such and such said that they showed up to set one day and they said this to a PA. Just remember that in that situation, the real core of it, the real core deep down, is that you genuinely don't know. You don't know that person. You don't know any of the people involved in the situation. And really, even hearing the story is more than you ever need to know about that situation. I shared a tweet the other day because I just found this tweet on Reddit that I liked, and several people inboxed me and said, hey, that, just so you know, that guy who wrote that tweet, it has been accused of domestic abuse. And I was like, okay. Like, I just was kind of like, you know, the feeling that I had is, and it's not that I'm defending the guy at all, or like, because that's not what I'm doing when I share his tweet. I'm not signing off on all of his behavior that he may or may not have done throughout his entire life. All of the behavior that he's been accused of. I just saw a tweet on Reddit. Like, if the expectation is that in order to share a video or a tweet or a joke that we find on the internet, we need to do an extensive Google back search on that person and make sure that they've never done anything potentially harmful or wrong in their life before, I don't think that that's a reasonable place for us to be in. And also what I thought was, the feeling that I had when those people inboxed me was, I just was like, I don't need to know that about this guy. That's not what I was sharing the tweet for. I wasn't sharing the tweet to say, I think that this guy is innocent of the accusations against him, or that I think that this guy's spouse is lying. I was sharing the tweet because I thought it was a good tweet. That's it. So hearing from all these people that, like, hey, just so you know, that guy was accused of doing this thing, which means he basically did it, I'm like, that's just more than I need to ever know about this person, you know? Because at the end of the day, like, that is someone's private life that I wasn't there for it. I don't know about it, and I don't need to know. And that's why I said that this situation is a situation where I resolve on the Bob Saget thing to just go, like, unless I hear the story of a victim, like a concrete victim of someone saying, when I was this years old, at this time, Bob Saget came into my life and he recorded my family and this is what happened. And, like, until I hear something, like, if I can find something like that, then sure, I'll be open. But also, like, but what I have no use for is just stories that I'm just hearing people share. I think that that we're too quick to certainty. I think that we're so uncomfortable with uncertainty that we just jump into certainty. And that's why I started with, like, the vaccine and the voting thing, that, or the election fraud, is, like, it's easy to talk about those things as though we have 100% certainty. But the reality is, like, we don't. We just have reasonable certainty. We have a reasonable certainty that, based on what the information that we've seen, based on the fact that Trump's entire legal team hasn't been able to produce anything of merit, we're pretty sure that nothing happened. You know, we can be reasonably certain. Nobody's been able to produce anything that's even remotely interesting in the way of hard evidence. So. But yeah, on a thing like that, you know, I think I was just a little triggered by this conversation that these ladies I was working with were having, because A, it was so soon after somebody had said something heinous and awful about me. And I was like, man, people really do just believe this stuff without even questioning it. Like, the fact that I asked these women, like, hey, where'd you hear that? And they couldn't even tell me. They were just like, oh, just everybody knows this. And then I looked it up and I was like, it doesn't seem like everybody does. It doesn't seem like common knowledge. They were like, oh, no, for sure. For sure it's common knowledge. I don't know. That kind of, it just kind of got to me that I just thought, I think that we're so, we always need to feel like we're certain about things and that we know things that we, at the end of the day, we know, at the end of the day, everybody, we don't know fucking anything. We don't know anything. Our smartest people, our smartest scientists and astrophysicists and don't know anything. Are just, they have like really good guesses. They have like really good estimations of how they think things are working and why. And that's about it. And they're constantly trying to reform through the scientific method. So I don't know. I just, you know, I think on certain things, like critical thinking, suss it out, try to figure it out. And on other things, like really be okay. It will, and really in all things, even things that you suss it out and that you critically think about, still know that at the core, at the very bottom, get comfortable with the fact that like at the bottom of all of it, there's uncertainty there. It's that play, that John Patrick Shanley play. Is that who wrote it? John Patrick Shanley? Who wrote Doubt? Is that who wrote it? That's what I want to say. John Patrick Shanley. I think that's right. Fact check me. But the play Doubt. Have you ever seen the movie Doubt with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Meryl Streep and Amy Adams? It's fantastic. But it's about this nun who is certain. She's certain. She is certain that she has ironclad proof that this this priest in her parish has molested this young boy. And she wasn't there for the events, and she doesn't have any like hard, you know, evidence that would be admissible in court, but she's got a feeling and she's just certain of it. And what the play does really well is it doesn't actually answer the question for you of whether or not he did. The play seems to be leaning in the direction that like it kind of looks like he did. Like it kind of looks like he most likely did. But it also leaves it open that like there's a few other things that could have been going on to make it look that way. It leaves open the possibility that like this kid was getting bullied because he's gay, and the priest was like the only person that was nice to him and was kind of like taking him under his wing and taking a shine to him because the priest might be gay too. And he was just sort of like, I know what it's like to feel ostracized, and that's all it was. And he because he tells the nun in several scenes, like, I can't tell you what went on privately between me and the kid because that's privileged information. Like, I'm a priest. He has my confidence, you know. But it makes it seem like he's guilty. And at the end of the play, the last line of the play is this nun who has been so certain, she just kind of gets choked up and she says, I have such doubt. I have such great doubt. And that's how the play ends. Is she kind of admits, like, at the end of the day, like, I feel really certain that I did the right thing by getting this guy to move and by calling this guy out. But also at the bottom of it all is I don't know. You know? I don't know. And so kind of embracing that uncertainty and embracing the humility of that uncertainty. I was going to come back to this. I wound up kind of like doing a little bit of like my own research, let's call it, into Bob Saget, just to see if I could find anything more. And this was after work. I couldn't really find anything substantive, but I watched one of his comedy specials. I'd never seen him do comedy before. I'd always heard that he was kind of a raunchy comic, and I watched one of his specials, and I listened to the Remembering Bob Saget episode of WTF with Mark Maron, where Mark plays clips from three different interviews with Bob over like a 10-year span. And a few observations. One is, holy shit, Bob Saget is so funny. He's so funny. He's so much funnier than I thought he would be. He was cracking me up while talking to Mark. And two is, he is filthy, but man, he's got like the quickest filthy brain mind. Like, he just goes to places, and he's also like dark. He just does really dark humor, but like in a good way. Like, he's like, it's not dark humor, like internet humor where you just say an awful thing and that's the joke. But, it's actually like clever, and it is gallows humor. But so Bob has had a lot of deaths in his family. Like, he's had two siblings die. His mother died. He's experienced a lot of like close personal deaths. And he says that to Mark at one point, and he goes, yeah, you know, I'm a, one of three, and my two siblings are dead, so I'm the only one who's still alive. And Mark goes, oh my God, how'd they die? And like fast as lightning, like as quick as lightning, Bob just goes, oh, well, they saw my act one night and they both killed themselves that night. Which is like so fucked up. Like, it's so fucked up to say, he's just, oh, well, they saw my act one night and they both committed suicide that night. But I started laughing so hard because like that's a comedian's, like a comedian's comedian joke. Like, and it is a joke. It's absolutely a joke. And it's really funny. And it's like, and it's not how his siblings died, obviously. But like, so funny to be like, yeah, my siblings came and watched me do my act and they couldn't take it. And like, also like, he's talking about something real. Like, his siblings are dead. So he gets to make that joke from a real place of real pain that he's experienced. And that's his process of, like, dealing with the grief. He's not just saying an awful thing for the sake of saying it. He's talking about something real. So, yeah, my observations were, I thought he was very funny. I did notice, like, in the interviews with Marc Maron, he made, like, three pedophile jokes. So I'm like, I took notice of it. I noticed that. I was like, well, he really does, like, that's like part of his repertoire. He like goes into that. And hey, maybe he's playing with the fact that he's heard the rumors, that he's heard people say it, because he made a joke once in 1982 or something about it. And like, since then there was like a rumor mill around it. And maybe he's just leaning into it and playing the part. You know, I don't know. The bottom line is, I don't know. You know, my takeaway after watching his special and listening to him with Mark is he seems like a genuinely nice guy. He seems like a guy who's philanthropic and tries to do the right things. He seems like he's, you know, genuinely just in love with his daughters and seems like a really good dad. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm no clearer on it than I was when those women first told me with certainty that he absolutely was. You know who I don't think went home and thought about it or looked it up was them, the people that I was talking to in the makeup chair. Unfortunately, you know, I think that's what I'm just trying to talk about, is just being like, we just got to get better at, and myself included here. I'm not speaking from a high horse, but just be better about like, embracing uncertainty, embracing the fact that at the end of the day, at the very bottom of it, you just don't know. And that's why I'm also not saying that Bob Saget is definitively not a sexual predator. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I wasn't able to find anyone who was alleging that about him. I wasn't able to find like a person who said this happened to me and Bob Saget did it. I think that's kind of a big thing that you need before making a claim like that. But even if there was, I think we can be a little quick to be like, oh, well, if someone said that, then that means. And again, I think if you're speaking with a victim who is telling you a story of a traumatic event that happened to them, your default setting should be to treat that situation as though they are telling you the truth. But I do also think that there is some validity and value to retaining privately in your own heart and in your own mind the understanding that at the end of the day, with anything that anyone tells you about their life, no matter how serious or how mundane, you don't actually know because you weren't actually there. In fact, that person doesn't actually know. Malcolm Gladwell has a great episode about how unreliable our own memories are. So even when a person is telling you, I was there, here's exactly how the story went down, chances are, if you talked to the two other people who were there at that time, they would tell you a similar version of the story, but it would probably be pretty different. There's another, I'm going to wrap it up pretty soon. I'm going to wrap it up. I think I've kind of made my point, but there's another great movie that came out this year that deals with this. Remember when I said it was going to be short? I said I was going to be quick, and then I wasn't quick at all. This is a full length episode. I went all the way. We went, hopefully I was making sense. I feel like I rambled a lot, but, there's another movie that came out in 2021 that I feel like just did not get the recognition it deserved. A lot of critics have been saying this about this movie, saying that like it really didn't deserve to flop as hard as it did. It was like a huge flop, a massive flop. This movie lost a lot of money and it really didn't deserve to. And the movie is The Last Duel, Ridley Scott's film with Matt Damon and Adam Driver and oh geez, what's her name from Killing Eve? Jodie Comer. Man, she's so great. She's so great. This movie I thought was fantastic. I just watched it for the first time. It's on, I believe it's on HBO. Oh no, it's on Apple. It's on, or is it? It's either on Apple Plus or HBO Max. One of those. You can watch it now on one of those. And you should. It's fantastic. I haven't seen this very often from like historical dramas, but the movie is, it's the same movie three times. They show you the same story three times from three different characters' perspectives. And the interesting thing is, I don't think that the movie is saying that like the first two characters are lying. The movie does imply that like the most accurate version of the events is the third version, or at least that the most important version of the events is the third version. It's a movie that chronicles a true story of a sexual assault that happened in the 1300s, in the late 1300s, in France. And the most important version of events is the victim's version of events. And that's the version that ends the movie. It's the third one that we get to hear. And it's certainly the most, probably the closest to the truth that matters the most. But I think the smartest thing that the movie does is that it doesn't paint it as though the first two accounts are lies. It paints it as though these are the accounts as seen by these people. So we get to hear from the woman who was assaulted. We get to hear first from her husband, his perspective of things, how he sees the events. Then we get to hear from the attacker, how the attacker experienced it. And then third and finally and most importantly, we get to hear her event of her version of events. It's really a fantastic structure for a film. It's wonderfully acted, very well written, and just a great movie. And it's about this topic of like, at the end of the day, subjective experience is a real thing. And there is an aspect of like, when we're watching the perspective of the attacker, there is an aspect of his perspective where it's like he genuinely is seeing things differently than she is and is thinking this is a different scenario than she is thinking it is. And that's not to say that like it makes it okay what happened. It's not okay what happens, but it's just that his experience of it is genuinely different. And I'm not going to go into too many more details. You should watch the movie. It's really good. My point is just to say that, yeah, subjective experience is a real thing, and people are experiencing things in different ways. I genuinely can't account for every single person's experience of me. You know, like I know that there are people out there who I've had interactions with in the past who, like, to me, maybe I said something that seemed really innocuous, and to them it was like an incredibly hurtful thing, and I'm not even aware of it. And they've been walking around for years being like, I can't believe he said that thing to me. And to me it was just like a really simple, mundane, innocuous thing. And that's just, you know, so the whole crux, and I've said it a million times in this episode, but I'll just wrap up with it, is that uncertainty is a perfectly reasonable place to be, and a perfectly reasonable position to have on something. It's perfectly reasonable to say, like, when someone asks you, what makes you so certain that the vaccines do work? Or what makes you such an expert in vaccine science? It's perfectly reasonable to say, like, I don't know. I'm not a virologist. I'm not a vaccine developer or a epidemiologist or a medical scientist. Like, I don't know. I just have... I believe it's reasonable to trust people who are. I believe it's more reasonable to trust people who are than to believe that all of those people are involved in some kind of global conspiracy to kill me, when they're the same people who develop all of my other medicine that I take without question. And I think it's also reasonable when someone brings you something like, hey, did you hear this about this celebrity that you don't know? To say, like, I would need more information before I could actually take a position on that. I think it's totally reasonable to be like, I don't know. I don't know that. And also to be like, my position on a lot of that stuff is like, I don't really care to know. Because it's just like, I won't know. I won't be able to know. I won't actually be able to get enough information. But, you know, with certain things, like I said, with Woody Allen, with Michael Jackson, with R. Kelly, with stuff like that, I can go, okay, all right, you know, with Harvey Weinstein, with Bill Cosby, with Kevin Spacey, but with certain, like, you know, just with certain people, I think it's reasonable to go, I don't know, and I don't have sufficient information to make me reasonably certain one way or the other. I think it's okay to, and we can apply that to more situations than just the two that I talked about in this episode. I think we can apply it to lots of episodes or lots of situations. Just the idea that being comfortable in uncertainty, accepting uncertainty as a baseline for most things, is an okay way to be. And not only will that, I think, help you and engage in a process of critical thought, but it might also help a little bit with your anxiety to get used to the idea that, like, it's okay not to know things. It's okay to not be certain about things. It's okay to not have all the answers about things. That's okay. You know? Cool. All right, we made it through that. I feel like that conversation was a little dicey. Might have been a little dicey. Might have prickled a few feathers. That's okay if it did. That's okay. You can let me know. You can reach out. Are you guys hearing that little echo? There's a little tin can next to me, like 3 feet away from me, where you put the logs when they're not being used. And I think my sound is reverberating off of it. I'm hearing it, but I don't know if it's making it into the microphone. If it is, that would be an awful shame. It's my first podcast with my brand new microphone. It would suck if this whole time I've been getting this weird dingy echo. Anyway, that's the episode. It's my birthday. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Patreon.com/AustinArcher is a great way to support this show. Thank you to all my Patreon patrons. I love you so much. This show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. You can go to themarmalademusic.com and tell Chris that you want to work with him and that you heard his work on this show, People Pleaser, and he will give you 20% off of your first project. If you tell him that, go to themarmalademusic.com to work with Chris on your audio project now. He's the best. Okay, that's it. That's the episode. We'll see you next week. Maybe with a guest, maybe not. Who knows? All right, take it breezy. Bye-bye. Love ya.
Be the people pleasers, the fancy way of being alive. Trying to do and say the things that make everyone okay is a way.